So in chapter 6, then Krishna is explaining how one must always think of Krishna within himself. And that is the best of all the yogis. So now in this chapter, he starts to explain what that means, how to come to that platform. So here in the first three verses, then Krishna explains how that one can get to know him by hearing about Krishna. We can know Krishna by hearing about Krishna. Text 1. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Now hear, O son of Prita, how by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, with mind attached to me, you can know me in full, free from doubt. I shall now declare unto you in full this knowledge, both phenomenal and numinous. This being known, nothing further shall remain for you to know. Out of many thousands among men, one may endeavor for perfection, and of those who have achieved perfection, hardly one knows me in truth." So, very few are interested in actual serious spiritual life. We see so many living entities, of those so few are human, of those so few are interested in a regulated lifestyle. So now in this regulated lifestyle, then very few are even interested in liberation, or actually trying to come to a proper platform of understanding. And of those, very few actually endeavor for Krishna. So Krishna here is pointing out how rare this is. But now we can understand him by associating with such persons and hearing about Krishna. That is the essential point. We can hear about Krishna, then we can develop that interest to attain Krishna, and we develop this knowledge about Krishna. So, and this knowledge that what we hear about Krishna purifies the heart. So this knowledge, this in association with advanced devotees, while we perform our duties without attachment, this brings us very quickly to the advanced platform. So now, this knowledge about or this devotion to Krishna is not attainable through every other method. So Krishna mentions here that one should hear, touch Trinu. And this is confirmed in the Bhagavatam, Srinvatam Swakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana. That by hearing, then that's how we're going to come to the advanced stage. Here's a point made by Srila Prabhupada about these many thousands among men. It is not possible for the Brahman realized impersonalist or the Paramatma realized yogi to understand Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as the son of Mother Yashoda or the charioteer of Arjuna. Even the great demigods are sometimes confused about Krishna. So it's only by hearing about Krishna from as he describes himself and as the great devotees describe. Otherwise, no one else can understand. So now Krishna is going to discuss about his energies. He's saying now he's going to explain about the phenomenal and the numinous. Phenomenal means the material world, numinous means the spiritual. So he's going to describe that here to Arjuna. And then once one knows this, matter, spirit, and the controller of both, then one knows everything. That is knowledge. Right? That is actual understanding of knowledge. So Krishna starts out here. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. Altogether, these eight constitute my separated material energies. So these are the basis of the whole material the whole material manifestation. That it's explained here that from you have the Mahat Tattva, that is when you have Pradhan, but Pradhan is just the matter itself, and it's doing nothing. But when you put in the living entities with the glance of Mahavishnu or Shambhu, then this transforms into Mahat Tattva. So now it is like it is ready to start to manifest. So this is the first of this. Then from here manifest the false ego. Then from the false ego, then we manifest all these elements. From the ego comes the intelligence, the mind, the ether, the air, the fire, the earth, the water. Each time you add the false ego. You have false ego, you add more, you get intelligence. You add again, you get the mind. You add again, you get ether. Like this, it just keeps going down. The false ego is the catalyst for creating all of this. And specifically from the false ego, then we see that the senses, and then from each of these you get the senses, the sense objects. Right? From earth, then you have fragrance, is the sense object. From? You have from earth, you have fragrance, and then the sense of smell, and you have the sense, the nose, like that. So like this, they all come out. From water, you get taste, you get the sense of taste, and you get the tongue. Then from fire, you get form, then the sight, it comes from there. From air, you get touch and the skin. From ether, then you get the hearing, sound, and the ears. And then from the false ego also manifests the working senses. The what is it? Hands, the legs, the voice, the anus, the genital. So all these manifest then from the false ego. So all the considerations basically of all these aspects is based on the ego. Because of our ego, then we will organize our life, our senses, and our activities all around that identity. So if that is not there, then we are not actually dealing with the material nature, not in a very serious way. Like this, 33. Yeah. So that's why Krishna always emphasizes working without attachment and without ego. Because when the false ego is not there, then we don't. Then all the basis of all these others to be material doesn't exist anymore. Right? Something exists because there's a situation. I remove the situation, then all those things are irrelevant. So when we remove the false ego in our work, then the activity doesn't have any material purpose anymore. So then, it's very easy to do something for Krishna. So much emphasis is always put on this point of removing the ego. Because by doing that, we change the ego that we are servant of Krishna. That means we see this energy, its inferior energy, as Krishna's. And we engage it in Krishna's service. Right? We do what is practical. Just like, let us say, it is most ideal you have a nail or something, and you get a very nice hammer of the proper weight and size, and you drive that nail in. Now, if you have to get the nail in and you don't have a hammer, you'll pick up anything, a rock or a piece of wood or a chunk of iron, anything, as long as you can get the nail in. So the point is here that the living entity ideally should be serving Krishna with spiritual senses, with his spiritual nature. But if that's not available, we use the material nature. Because it's Krishna's energy also. It's not something different. It's only very much mentioned as material nature because we become attached to it. We have a false ego thinking I'm the enjoyer, and we become attached to the results, the fruits of the work. But when there's no desire for the work, there's no attachment, there's no ego, then we're not factually dealing with material activity. It's still arranged by Krishna through the three modes, but that's not important, because anyway we're not worried about that anyway. If we think about it, we don't have to contemplate on the heart working or, you know, the digestion working, or us breathing, or, you know, falling asleep, waking up. We don't have to worry. They all just happen. You know, we get hungry, we get thirsty, we have to use the toilet, all these different things. They just happen. The modes of nature are just carrying them out. So we don't have to worry about that. Basically, if we think about it, what it is that we're mainly experiencing is just what the mind goes through. The mind's desires, the fulfillment of those desires. We're not worried about what's happening, how it's working. We're just worried about the desire being fulfilled. You know? So if there's some particular detail we want to this, we may put our mind on those details to see that they're happening. But if we notice, we're not actually doing. Right? Just like you're doing something. Say you do it every day. You're cooking or something. You're not thinking, okay, now push the arm forward, now bring it back, now move it at a little bit of a different angle, now push it again, like this. No, you just want to move this here, move that there, you know, make this flip over, not flip it out of the pot. You push the one out of the pot, so you push a little less. You're not actually controlling what's going on. You're just thinking, I want it to go this way, I want it to go that way, and it's happening. If you actually think about it. So what we're experiencing is what the mind's experiencing. And then the senses, the mind then brings in the information that the senses bring, you know, and the working senses work. You know, you don't think about walking. Like a small child, they get up and they fall over. No practice. Right? And then they think, you know, this step, they kind of like want to move, and then like, but an adult never even thinks at all. You just walk, oh, I want to go here, you just go. You know, some big noise, you look, you run. You don't think, it just happens. It's just the experience of the mind. So when Krishna says it's just being carried out by the modes of nature, it doesn't mean anyone becomes a zombie when they work like this. No, they just recognize that that is what's going on. I'm just desiring it and it's happening. Right? I'm desiring it, the Lord's sanctioning it, the three modes of nature are carrying it out. So I may desire down to some fine detail, but it's just happening. This is what Krishna is pointing out. So therefore, we shouldn't think that we're the ones carrying it out. Just because we thought about it didn't mean we made it happen. Right? Isn't it just like you're watching something, you're watching some children play, you know, and they're playing ball, and this one's doing this, this one's doing that, and you're thinking, yeah, this one should do this, this one should do it, but it doesn't necessarily happen like that. If it happens like that, you can't claim, yes, I thought it should happen like that, it happened like that. It doesn't. So the material nature carries these things out. We just desire, even to a minute detail, but still it's happening, is being carried out by the modes. And so in this, if we understand that, then we can see, I'm not the doer. Right? The modes of nature are doing the things. I'm desiring, Krishna's sanctioning. So Krishna is the ultimate authority. So I should be doing things for Him. This is what I should be doing. It should be done for Him. So then we work with that. I'm not. So the result, we don't worry about. Because it's, even if we worry about it, it's going to happen the way the modes of nature arrange it anyway. Right? How Krishna sanctions it. We have a desire, it's not necessarily it's going to work the way we want it. If it did, then you would find 5 billion overly successful people on the planet. Because everybody's thinking, yes, it should go like this, and it should go like that, and every businessman would be a billionaire, and everybody would just, you know, everyone would be the best. But it's not happening like that. We desire it, we think it, we endeavor for it, but the result isn't necessarily what we want. You know, or it may be what we want, but it's not that we know it will happen. So it's just, it happens that way. And that's by the arrangement of the modes of nature. So we understand anyway the fruit is going to come according to how Krishna sanctions it and the modes of nature give it to us. It's not going to happen in a different way. Therefore, then, since it's happening like that, it's not us, then it becomes more easy to understand, okay, then this fruit actually meant for Krishna, because I'm not doing it. I may have the desire for it, but it doesn't mean it's mine. Because I didn't arrange it. I simply desired it. That's all I've done. Then one can give up the desire for the fruit, and one can see Krishna, it's Krishna, it should be done for Krishna. Not only we give up the desire for the fruit, because otherwise the karma yogi, right, can be just a materialistic person who is interested in becoming freed from sin, or maybe interested in elevating themselves to a higher platform. They're pious. They perform. They just know it's proper to do things like this. You know, they've heard their mother, father talk about it. They've read it in the scriptures. You know, like this. They've heard others speak. So they just do. They're pious. But they don't know that it's to be done for Krishna. They may have given up the attachment, but you have to attach yourself to Krishna. That was what Krishna was making the point in the last chapter. Is sannyas and working for Krishna are the same. But of the two, working for Krishna is better, because then you have both. You've detached. To attach yourself to Krishna means you have to detach yourself from Maya, but you've gotten the goal. Well, those who renounce may have given up the work, detached themselves, but if they don't attach themselves to Krishna, how long can you remain unattached in this way? The soul by nature is ananda. That means there must be attachment somewhere. There is attachment. Nobody is unattached. It's just where the attachment is. Right? We've either attached to the senses, attached to the emotions, and that's generally called a materialist. You know, a gross materialist. Then the jnani gives these up. Attachment to the senses, attachment to the emotions. But since they don't attach themselves to spiritual emotions and spiritual engagements in the senses, they can only then act on the platform of Brahman. And Brahman, platform, is Sandini potency, eternality. It's not Ananda. So now the soul tries to situate himself in Sandini, but the soul is Sat Chit Ananda. So Sandini, Hladini, and Samvit. So it means he can only deal with a third of his nature. It's not complete knowledge. Little bit of knowledge, he's Brahman. That's the beginning stage of spiritual. That's where it starts. The whole spiritual existence, the whole existence, material also, is situated on Brahman. Brahmanohi pratishtaham. Krishna is Brahman. Everything is situated on that. The material, the spiritual, that's what's holding it. The Adhara Shakti. That's what's holding everything. So it's just the beginning stage. Of course, when it compared to material knowledge, that's very great, but it's very minimal. So after a while, they're unsatisfied because the chit and ananda aspects are not dealt with at all. Ananda, nothing. Because when we say Brahmananda, it's just called Brahmananda because it's ananda compared to the material world, but it's not ananda at all. Because there's ananda comes from reciprocation between two living entities. That's where ananda is. So Brahmananda means I'm happy that I'm not suffering. That's Brahmananda. Right? That's Brahmananda. It doesn't last. It's only a momentary thing. In the beginning you think it's great. Like you're outside, very hot, suffering, too hot. You come inside and there's a nice fan. Right? So for a moment or two, you think, oh, this is so nice, because now the pain of the heat is going away. But once the pain of the heat is gone, is there any happiness anymore? You don't even notice the fan's there. So at first, you just sit there under the fan. You don't want to move, don't want to do anything. Someone says, hey, come sit. No, wait. You know, I'm enjoying this fan. Right? But as soon as that's gone, you've forgotten about the pain in the material world. Then immediately, you know, it's like, okay, now what to do, what's going on in the room, what's happening, and you go. Right? And it's only, and then you see, oh, outside something's there, that looks interesting. Then you walk outside and you remember, oh, it's hot out here. So that's what happens to the Brahma bodies. They're in their Brahman, and they're sitting there for billions of years. But as soon as the pain of the material existence just evaporates, well, they're not thinking about that anymore. then they have to do activity. And they've forgotten about the pain in the material world, so then the only activity they know is material, so they come back. And as soon as they come back, then they understand. You know, especially when they come back as a rock, or a tree, or a blade of grass. Then, so, yeah. So the whole thing is, this is the material energy, and we don't have to involve ourselves with it. Right? More than what we need to do our service. Our service is needed, and we desire and endeavor for those things, but we understand that the modes of nature are arranging according to how Krishna is wanting it to happen. So whatever is happening, it's for Krishna, arranged by Krishna, right? Through his agents. Then we are happy. Then he goes on to explain. Now that was the material energy, right? Means we're talking, knowledge is chit, the living entities, achit, the material nature, and Ishwara, the Lord. So we've just discussed achit, the material nature. Now, in the fifth verse, he discusses chit. Besides these, O mighty Arjuna, Arjuna, there is another, superior energy of mind, which compromises the living entities who are exploiting the resources of this material inferior nature. So that's the living entity. So just here, they're exploiting the material energy. Then, Ishwara. All created beings have their source in these two natures. Of all that is material and all that is spiritual in this world, know for certain that I am both the origin and the dissolution. So here now is the discussion of Ishwara. But here the Ishwara in the way of origin, creation, and dissolution. And in the material sphere, then we have one more, which is the maintainer, which is the seventh verse. O conqueror of wealth, there is no truth superior to me. Everything rests upon me as pearls are strung on a thread. So then, now Krishna has described these three in essence. He says, now I'm going to explain to you, you know, that knowledge by once hearing, you don't need to know anything else. So then it gives the essence. You'll see this. Rupa Goswami, the Acharyas, they do this. They first give, just in a nutshell. So here in four verses, he's talked about chit achit ishwar, which is knowledge. Then you take each and you expand them out a little bit more, then you get into more detail. You'll find Rupa Goswami does this, like in the Nectar Devotion. He'll generally give two or three levels of explanation. Like in the sixth chapter of the Nectar Devotion, he describes all the aspects of sadhana bhakti. Then he goes and spends next so many chapters explaining each of those points of 64 items one by one, which covers many, many chapters. But first he gives it all to you in one place so you can see it, you know, like an overview. So this concept of overview, like that is very natural. It's a Vedic system. So Krishna is doing that here. So now, here, we're previously jnana, when Krishna was talking about jnana in the previous chapters, means in the first six chapters, he was specifically meaning knowledge of the soul, that the soul is different from matter. And he would touch upon the point that the real knowledge then is when you understand that there is the Supreme Lord and we try to do things for him. But the emphasis was mainly on doing your duties with knowledge that we are not the body. Right? So the karma and jnana aspect were there. So jnana was there. But now Krishna is bringing out the fuller manifestation of this knowledge, that means knowing him. Then it's actually complete. Then it's actually complete. When you understand yourself, the material nature, and the relationship of Krishna, then it becomes complete. So we see in here, in these middle six chapters, the emphasis then is on this aspect of bringing out knowledge of Krishna. Krishna, our relationship with Krishna, devotional service, what it actually means. So we'll see the emphasis is here. And a lot of emphasis, as we see will come up, is on the very advanced platform. Previous platforms, we're talking basically about the Madhyam and the beginning stages of Uttam. But now you'll see in this chapter he'll talk about the you know, specifically more on the Uttam and the advanced stages beyond that. You know, the actual, you know, the full manifestation of bhakti, like that. So now here in the where are we? So now Krishna explains how he is the essence of everything. Now he's explained material nature and the living entities. And himself is the maintainer, creator, and the destroyer. So after telling that everything is resting on him like pearls are strung on a thread, that means you can't see the thread, but without the thread, it is not a necklace. It's just loose pearls. But because the thread is there, it's actually a necklace. So it's held up by the thread, but you can't see the thread. But just that it's held up, an intelligent person knows there's something inside. So now Krishna is pointing out how he's the thread in the whole material existence. Verse 8. O son of Kunti, I am the taste of water, the light of the sun and the moon, the syllable Om in the Vedic mantras. I am the sound in ether and ability in man. I am the original fragrance of the earth, and I am the heat and fire. I am the life of all that lives, and I am the penances of all ascetics. O son of Prita, know that I am the original seed of all existences, the intelligence of the intelligent, and the prowess of all powerful men. I am the strength of the strong, devoid of passion and desire. I am sex life, which is not contrary to religious principles. O Lord of the Bharatas, Arjuna, know that all these states of being, be they of goodness, passion, or ignorance, are manifested by my energy. I am, in one sense, everything, but I am independent. I am not under the modes of material nature, for they, on the contrary, are within me. So here he's pointing out, whatever there is, there's something you have, and it's considered in either an object, or, you know, some engagement with the senses, or something in a relationship, or something that you consider wonderful, or appreciate. If we look, the essence of any of that is Krishna. That's what he's pointing out. So actually what you're appreciating is Krishna. It's not the material energy. It's not even the living entity. It's Krishna. But because we're conditioned, we see the material energy and we think it's that. Right? He points out here, he's the taste of water, so we think it's the water. The thing we're appreciating about the water is its taste. That's what we're interested in. One's very thirsty when it drinks water. It tastes very nice. You know, you get some water, it's not so nice. It tastes bad. So it's not good water. It's still liquid. Right? But it's the taste. Right? One could say, no, it's liquid because I'm very thirsty. No, I give you a water that doesn't taste so good. Some really heavy mineral water. It's got a little bit of sulfur in it and stuff like that, you know. And you'll say, this is not nice. You won't drink it. So the whole idea is that it's the taste that one is interested in. So that is Krishna. Or in the light of the sun and the moon. That's what's interesting in the sun, right? We're not interested in the sun and something else. It's the light. When it comes up, it's daylight. When the moon's out, it looks very nice and it does things. We can see, makes it pleasant, makes a nice atmosphere. So it's the light. Okay? Which is the syllable Om in the Vedic mantras. Without Om, the mantras have no effect. Only when Om is there, then they have effect. Therefore, you'll see every Vedic mantra starts with Om and ends with Om. Always. It must be there. And he is the sound in ether and the ability of man. The ether is sound. Without sound, there's no real meaning to ether. Because it carries all the sounds it does. That's the essential element, essential aspect of ether. And the ability in man. Man can do so many things, therefore we consider him so nice, right? It means animals can do things, one thing better. We figure man can do so many different things and all this. And we think, well, it's so much the intelligence, it may not be so much the ability, it's the intelligence. But he says he's the intelligent of the intelligence. So whatever there is, he's the original fragrance of the earth. You put something in the earth, you get out, you get a flower, you get a nice fragrance. All these different flowers smell very nice, but that's all because they're taken from the earth. All those fragrances are in the earth. Otherwise the flower couldn't get them out. So Krishna is the essence of everything. So that's what he's pointing out here. And the strength of the strong, devoid of passion and desire. Just using strength, just brute strength, no one appreciates brute strength. But controlled strength for protecting, for doing something, that's appreciated. Everyone appreciates. Someone who's very powerful and uses their strength for the proper protection and maintenance of others. And everyone appreciates that. So that strength, that is Krishna. Just brute strength, that's nothing special. Buffaloes also have brute strength. Like that. You know, so it's not a great quality. But controlled strength, used in a proper way, people think this is very nice. So all these states of being, Krishna says, be they passion, goodness, or ignorance, they're all coming from him. Everything's coming from him. Like that. So he's saying he is everything. In that everything's come from him, he's entered everything. But at the same time, he's still aloof. As you mentioned before, this material nature, my separated material energies. So the word is bhinna. That is separated. He's complete. He's purnam. Everything that comes from him is also purnam. Because he is there. He has entered it. But it functions on its own. So he is independent. And something that is supported by some can't say it's superior to. So modes of nature, the material nature, is working under Krishna's support. So it can't be greater. So in this way, Krishna says that they are within him. They have no control over him. So that's important. Is that he's controlling the material nature, he's controlling the living entities. But the material nature and the living entities are not controlling him. So that point is being brought out here. So this is the point, position of achinta bheda bheda tattva. It's him, it's not him. Right? Simultaneously it's him, it's not him. So then in the next few verses, then Krishna describes how who can know Krishna and who cannot know Krishna. Because now he's talking knowledge, and that you should know the knowledge. Once you know this, there's nothing else to be known. And now he's pointing out there's still qualifications for knowing this knowledge. Some have it, they learn. Some don't, they'll never learn. So now he gives this in the next two verses, 13 and 14. Deluded by the three modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance, the whole world does not know me, who am above the modes and inexhaustible. This divine energy of mine, consisting of the three modes of material nature, is difficult to overcome. But those who have surrendered unto me can easily cross beyond it. So those who are deluded by the modes, they think they are the doer. They have so many ideas because of their false ego. They can never know Krishna. Because all they know is the modes, so you'll see everything according to your modes. Prabhupada gives the example of the frog in the well. Another frog comes and starts talking about the ocean. So all he knows, the only water he's ever seen is the water in his well. So, you know, according to his brain, okay, maybe is the ocean so big, huh? So my, you know, if you're in something, you think it's very big. Right? I found myself, I'm living in this grass hut. You know, it's probably one of the biggest grass huts that you'll find in Bengal or India. And I'm thinking it's quite big. Then I remember we went to Bangalore for the opening. So the Bangalore temple is situated on a hill. So you have to go, it's like, you have to go up about, you know, it's a lift of, I don't know, 50, 75 feet just to get to the bottom of the temple. Then from there it goes up. So then And it's huge. It's a huge place. Very huge place. So we were in Bangalore for like 10 days. And then when we came back, into the Gurukul, and I walked into the Gurukul, and I was looking at my hut, and I was thinking, boy, it's just a small hut. This is really small. And then I was looking around Mayapur, and everything was small. The only thing that was big was the samadhi. Everything else was medium or small. I mean, it was small. So it's just what you get used to. So this frog's been in his well, and he thinks this amount of water in his well is really big. So when you talk about the ocean, which is, you know, vast, then okay, what, 2 times, 3 times, 10 times? You know, you can think that in your head. The frog can't accommodate the ocean, right? It's just, it doesn't make sense to him. You don't find frogs in the ocean. They stay away from it. You find them in ponds, in puddles, but not in oceans. Like that. So it's the living entities who are controlled by the modes, bewildered, they can't know Krishna. Because they will try to understand Krishna like this Dr. Frog. And they will think, yeah, so Krishna is, okay, so he's in the mode of, okay, he's better than all of us, and that's so he's situated in goodness. He's the form of goodness. So then, okay, I can relate to that. And we say, no, he's not that. He's beyond that. He's spiritual. It's like, what do you mean? What's that? Never heard of it. And become bewildered. So that's that point is there. When we're bewildered by the modes, then we're bewildered by time and space. Right? Time is movement. Space is our sphere of activities. So we know this only. And we can't understand Krishna, who's beyond time and space. So they can't understand. Then it's pointed out that one who surrenders to Krishna, then you can understand, because Krishna reveals himself. Because Krishna is sanctioning anyway, and then his energy is doing. So in the material world, the Mahamaya is arranging through the modes of nature. She's called Trigunamayi. So when Krishna gives a sanction for material activities, the three modes act. And then things happen. You know, or by adjusting the modes and you understand something or don't understand, like this. So the same way is that when Krishna is pleased, then he sanctions that Yogamaya will reveal knowledge about himself. Then we can know Krishna. Otherwise, who can know Krishna? Krishna is beyond what we are. Right? You have the material nature, you have the jivas, you have the spiritual nature. But beyond that is Krishna. Krishna is something else. Right? Spiritual nature comes from him. Generally we think he is spiritual nature. No, that is his energy. He is something else. Krishna is beyond all that. He's beyond spiritual. We say in the spiritual realm this and that, but he is beyond that. So only if he allows or reveals, then we can understand him. To what degree, you know, Krishna allows. To what degree we need. And then that's it. So there's no other way. We're not going to figure Krishna out, because he's something else. Even we're talking materialists, bewildered by the modes, can't figure him out, because he's thinking he's the modes. Even we're situated on the transcendental platform, still we can't figure out Krishna, because he's beyond transcendental. He's the source of transcendental. He's the source of the material world. Same time, he's separate. It's him. He's entered it. He maintains it, creates it, destroys it, but he's beyond it. So we can't understand these things. If Krishna reveals, then we get some idea, small idea. Otherwise, that's it. Because the point is, we want to develop love for Krishna as a person. Right? So unlimited knowledge about himself, there's no need. That service, having unlimited knowledge about Krishna, is already given Ananta. That's his service. We don't have to worry about that. Ananta Dev, with his thousands of hoods, has been speaking about Krishna's glories from time immemorial. He's still speaking today. He'll be talking for time immemorial. So the service is already taken, of knowing everything about Krishna. Right? And Krishna is expanding, so therefore Ananta is speaking more and more.
You know?
So like that, we can know something. How much Krishna wants us to know. How much we need to know. To convince ourselves, to convince others, to engage in the devotional service properly. So that we'll get. So Krishna is pointing that out here. Then, after this telling who can know and who doesn't know. In other words, those who are bewildered by the modes and those who are not bewildered by the modes, who surrender to Krishna. Let's say those who have surrendered, then they are not become not bewildered by the modes. So now Krishna gives the details of that. Okay, who are the people who are, who don't know Krishna because they're bewildered by the modes? So then he says there are four kinds of persons who are bewildered. This is text 15. Those miscreants who are grossly foolish, who are lowest among mankind, whose knowledge is stolen by illusion, and who partake of the atheistic nature of demons, do not surrender unto me. So now that one less than, so these kind of persons, they are not actually in knowledge, because knowledge means knowing matter, spirit, and the controller of both. They may be greatly learned on the material platform, but because they don't actually know spirit factually, they cannot be called acharyas or mahajans. He makes this point, brings out this point. So now each of these is described, and because there's so much fine wording here, then I'm going to read some of these, so please bear with us. This is Prabhupada gives his points, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Baladeva Vidyabhushan. They all, talking on the point, then illuminate various aspects of it. Srila Prabhupada writes, most often, this is the mudhas, most often those who work very hard day and night to clear the burden of self-created duties say that they have no time to hear of the immortality of the living beings. To such mudhas, material gains which are destructible are life's all in all, despite the fact that the mudhas enjoy only a very small fraction of the fruit of labor. So some important points here is that they're working day and night to clear burdens of self-created duties. Right? They've decided, well, I need four cars and I need a four-bedroom apartment and I got to live in this neighborhood and I got to do like that and I got to ride on the train for 2 hours into this city to make the money. They create the duties. So the burden of these duties they created themselves because of their desires. So they carry these desires and work like an ass. Therefore, they're called mudhas. And because of this, they have no time. No time to hear about spiritual things. No time. Yeah. They're just not interested. And they work very hard. But you see, they only get a small amount of the fruit of their labor. Now they say someone's working in a factory, right? He gets paid a small amount, but the person who owns the factory will take his work and sell it for a big profit, right? If all the workers in the factory were getting the full value of the work they were doing, then there's nothing to sell afterwards, right? All the profits would go to the laborers. But because it doesn't, then business goes on. That's how business works, right? Because the mudas, they work and only get a fraction. And then that leaves something for someone else to sell and make money, right? Like that. So like this, they're working very hard. They take their economic gain as their material gains as their all in all. But even that, for the work they do, they only get a little bit back. And all these ideas of how they have to work so hard and suffer so much is all self-imposed. They've decided to do like this. They've decided to have so much material facility. Therefore, they're suffering. Then Vishwanath Chakravarti, he points out that these mudas are just like animals. Those who are condemned by fate avoid the nectarian topics of Lord Achyuta and listen instead to impious narrations. They are just like dogs eating stool. And who will not serve Mukunda other than one who is less than human? So the muda has no time to hear topics about Krishna, but somehow or another he has topics to hear all kinds of mundane nonsense. So it's said like the dog eating stool, like that. This means they have no direction, they're just living on their own, right? The street dogs, they'll eat anything, like that. So he makes this point. And who will not listen to these? Someone less than an animal. Human listens to transcendental subjects. That's the meaning. Human life begins with a tato brahma jigyasa. Know a tato brahma jigyasa? Then it's two-legged animal. So he's making that point. These mutas are just so, they don't hear. And then Balade Vidyabhushan, some are bewildered, mudha, by maya. Their intelligence dulled by fruit of work. They think that I, Lord Vishnu, am like, that he, meaning, this is Krishna speaking, am like Lord Indra, an agent of the law of karma, and that, like jivas, I am subject to karma. So that point was made before, deluded by the three modes. They think, they don't know Krishna. They think Krishna's, I am the deluded think, as I am the subject to the modes of nature, so is Krishna. They just think he's also, okay, like Indra is there, he's great, powerful, we can get so many. So like that, Krishna is also great, powerful, like that. So the mudas, if they even do think about Krishna, that's as far as they can get. Their relating with Krishna is, because he's made the point, these don't surrender. Is that Krishna is just like one of the demigods, that's all. So he's also part of the modes of nature. He's just like me, so you know what's the big deal? Why I have to worship him? So many demigods are there. So that's the mudas. Then the Naradhamas. Some very interesting points come out here. Srila Prabhupada writes, in the Gita, the Supreme Personality of Godhead clearly states that there is no authority above him and that he is the Supreme Truth. The civilized form of human life is meant for man's reviving the lost consciousness of his eternal relationship with the Supreme Truth, the Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, who is all-powerful. Whoever loses this chance is classified as a Naradhama. So this point here is, it's meant for reviving the lost consciousness, means consciousness we had that we've lost, and whoever loses this chance is classified as a Naradhama. The opportunity is there. He doesn't take it. He loses it. This is the difference between the mudha and the Naradhama. Naradhama is just a fool. I mean, the mudha is just a fool, an ass. Naradhama has the chance for devotional activities, but does not take it. Therefore, he's the lowest. Right? Otherwise, normally you'd think the mudha is the lowest. They're the most, you know, rough and, you know, uncultured. Here, someone who can be the civilized form of human life is meant for reviving the lost consciousness. So here you have a so-called civilized person who is not taking to Krishna consciousness. He has the opportunity, does not take it. So now this can be brought out, seen in two ways. Someone who has the opportunity this life and loses it, or, as brought out by the other acharyas, is this can also mean who, as we were talking before, those who perform some devotional activity, then but didn't complete, they became distracted by the senses, went to the heavenly planets, enjoyed, come back in the families of aristocratic or righteous families, Brahmins or nobility, one place it mentions nobility, or aristocratic, big Vaishya families. And they get the opportunity for Krishna consciousness, they don't take it. Means that fallen yogi who gets the opportunity to again take it up, doesn't take it. Right? Or someone who is practicing in this life, and then after a while they just decide, well, this is useless. It's not that they fell down. That person, Krishna makes very clear, is never lost. The person, they've taken up the service and they started. Now Krishna is not going to, he's going to try to engage them. But now, someone's rejected. Oh, this is a useless process. Not that they became deviated by the sign, they just decided this is useless. You know, it's no meaning for me. That person is Naradhama. So these are the different classes. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that Naradhamas, having become civilized human beings by practicing devotional service for some time, later decide that devotional practices are impractical for achieving their aims in life, in other words, material aims, and thus whimsically discard devotional service. The symptom of their being adhama, or the most fallen, is their intentional rejection of devotional service. They intentionally reject it. Someone just becomes deviated. They're not intentionally, just they can't maintain, it's too difficult, or maybe they just kind of take a break from the drive of devotional service. But here it intentionally gives it up, it's useless. Then Vishwanath adds to this, some people are made into the worst of men by the influence of Maya. Even having received a most excellent status by birth in a brahminical or high-class family, they become degraded to a low-class status by attachment to poetry or wealth. As stated, such people have been cheated by fate. Abandoning the nectar of topics about Lord Achyuta, they listen to impure narrations, just as dogs eat excrement. And so the opportunity is there. They're in cultured families, they don't take it. Right? They just are too attached to all their nonsense, you know, mundane literature. Like that. Literature, their wealth, their position, their status. You know? So like in the Kali Yuga, demons are given the chance to take birth in Brahmins' families. Because then they can take up devotional service. But they may also just become proud and then think that that's good enough. So this is Naradhama. Someone who is in a cultured position but refuses to take up devotional service. They come in contact with it, but they're not interested. They throw it as useless. It won't give me what material facilities and desires I want, so what's the use of it? Okay. Then Mayaya Pratijnanas, Srila Prabhupada explains, in the Gita, in plain and simple language, it is stated that Sri Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There is none equal to or greater than Him. He is mentioned as the father of Brahma, the original father of all human beings. In fact, Sri Krishna is said to be not only the father of Brahma, but also the father of all species of life. He is the root of the impersonal Brahman and Paramatma. The Supersoul in every entity is his plenary portion. He is the fountainhead of everything, and everyone is advised to surrender unto his lotus feet. Despite all these clear statements, the Mayaya Pratijnana deride the personality of the Supreme Lord and consider him merely another human being. They do not know that the blessed form of human life is designed after the eternal and transcendental feature of the Supreme Lord. That they just, in other words, they've studied and this and that, but they just come to the conclusion that Krishna is just, you know, in his human form, he's just ordinary like us. So they have some knowledge, but that knowledge is actually stolen by Maya. So they can't get transcendental knowledge, even though they study scriptures, they can't get. They can only get material knowledge. So this is Mayaya Pratijnana. Then, it continues here. Yeah, it continues here. Maya Pratijnanas often follow atheistic Shankya philosophy and think that creation is enacted by material nature. Yeah. So then, Prabhupada explains that Mayaya Pratijnanis are mostly very learned fellows, great philosophers, poets, literati, scientists, etc. So they think the cause of everything is the material nature. Generally you'll find like that. So as they study, they're very so-called intelligent, but they can't tell the difference between matter and spirit. They can't see it. So even Krishna is there, they think he's also matter. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur states, some people have the qualification of having studied scripture, but their knowledge has been stolen by illusion. That is to say, they think that only the Narayan form of God residing in Vaikuntha is the eternal object of attainment by devotional service, and the mere human forms of Rama and Krishna and so on are not. This is described in the words, fools deride me when I appear in my human form. Even when those persons are apparently surrendering to Krishna, they actually are not surrendering to Him. So when Krishna performs His pastimes, Krishna in the Gita, all these, they'll just think that this is not actually the Supreme Lord. Supreme Lord's only in Vaikuntha, Forum, that's God, and all these other manifestations are not. Therefore, they can't surrender to Krishna, even though they think they are, but they can't. Because if they think that Krishna's form is material like that, then they can't actually progress nicely. They're kind of like a devotional impersonalist, like that. It's not, you find that. Some in South, some temples are like that. There's a Guru Vaira is like that. It's a temple established, the worship is established by Shankaracharya. And they worship Krishna, baby Krishna. And for the whole day they're just doing devotional activities, kirtan, parikrams for the deity. It's famous for all the devotional activities that go on there. It's prasadam, everything. But their whole idea is that, you know, that they're just basically worshiping themselves. So they can't tell. So you have these impersonalists who they take the path of bhakti rather than renunciation to try to attain their means. Then Baladeva Dibhushan explains in Krishna's words, so right, Krishna talking. Others, such as the proponents of Shankya philosophy, have had their knowledge stolen by Maya. The Shankyas belittle me, even though my qualities of omniscience, omnipotence, and being the creator of all and the bestower of liberation are proclaimed by thousands of revealed scriptures. Instead, they whimsically propose that material nature is the creator of all and the bestower of liberation. The reason that they raise hundreds of such faulty and deceptive arguments is simply the influence of Maya. So they just think it's the material nature that is creating everything and going. Because we have here the modes of nature carrying out everything. So they think, yes, it's creating everything. It's independent from the Lord. So they can't understand that there's beyond. They take the scriptures. This is the thing, is that the six bogus philosophies are based on the Vedic literatures. So here they've taken the point that the soul is not the doer, but the material nature is. But they don't take it beyond that Krishna is sanctioning and controlling the material nature. Therefore, their philosophy then comes out wrong. But it's based on the Vedas. So these persons have studied the scriptures, but they come to this conclusion that Krishna's form is material. And they can't surrender to Krishna. Then the Asuras take shelter of the demoniac nature. Srila Prabhupada writes that they are openly atheistic. Such persons whose very principle of life is to decry the personality of Godhead cannot surrender unto the lotus feet of Sri Krishna. Jarasandha, this is then, Bhujan points out, Jarasandha is an example, Jarasandha is an example of an asura. Although he had knowledge, jnana, he hated Krishna and even wanted to kill him. Right? And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that Krishna is stating, some people have taken shelter of the demoniac nature. Demons such as Jarasandha aim and shoot arrows at my personal form. While these persons try to obliterate my personal form, they attack my form with bad logical arguments based on such evidence as the fact that my form is visible. Such persons certainly do not surrender unto me. Baladeva Dibhushan writes, some people have taken shelter of the demoniac nature by the influence of Maya. These are the proponents of the philosophy that the Absolute is pure spirit, without any qualities. In the same manner as asuras try to shoot arrows at my personal form, the source of all bliss, the Mayavadis attack my personal form, which is proven in Shruti to be the eternal embodiment of living spirit. The Mayavadis thus try to destroy my personal form with their arguments. The reason for such a mentality arising in them is again simply the influence of Maya. So we see the difference between the Mayaya Pratijnana and the Asuras. Is the Maya Pratijnana, they're into their knowledge. And, you know, the topic of Krishna may be a side thing. They'll just say it's not spiritual. They just don't, it doesn't come into their consideration. He's kind of out of the purview of their consideration. The Shankyas, they don't even consider God. It's just material nature. You divide up the elements like this, and if you understand all this, then the living entity can somehow or another become free. How it means the material nature liberates it. It's just they have some strange philosophy. those are the material Shakyas. But they don't really deal with the Lord. Right? Or they think, yes, there is God, but it's not this form. It's, you know, some other form. But the Asuras, specifically, it's like their purpose in life is just to decry God. They're against His personal form. You know, if they have the opportunity, they try to, you know, destroy Krishna. And if they don't, then they say, he can't be God, we can see Him. God, you can't see. They try to make Him, you know, formless and no qualities, nothing. So the Mayavadis and those demons that try to personally attack Krishna, these are all Asuras. So the difference, you see the difference? One is it's just they're into their intellectual platform, and Krishna doesn't really come into their sphere of activities or thoughts. And the Asuras, God is very much in their thoughts, but they're totally against Him. Right? Their whole philosophy is based against God. The Maya Pratigyanas, they get bewildered by something else other than God, right? And spend their whole time there. But the Asuras, their whole energy is on disproving that God is there. Like that. So that's the difference. Then Krishna describes the four pious souls who surrender. Text 16. O best among Bharatas, four kinds of pious men begin to render devotional service unto me. The distressed, the desire of wealth, the inquisitive, and he who is searching after knowledge of the Absolute. So then, here Srila Prabhupada explains that although these souls are not pure devotees, they are pious. They can be elevated to pure devotional service by the association of a pure devotee. So then there are three. The Artha is someone who has some distress, and they want that relieved. Some disease, some sickness, some calamity, some other material miseries, but they go to God for it. They're not turning somewhere else. They turn to God. So this is Artha. An example of this is Gajendra. He was Artha. He was having some problem. You know, the crocodile had firmly fitted himself to his foot, and he was not able to release himself from this, you know, bite of the crocodile. So with time then, he remembered the Lord, and he turned to the Lord, and the Lord saved him. And his chapters are Gajendra Moksha. So it's a very important chapter, because this is how the Artha became perfect. Then we have the Jigyasu, who is curious. They want to know about what is soul, what is this, what is that. And so he approaches Krishna to know all these things. So the example is given of Shonaka Rishi as an example. They want to understand the soul or to become self-realized. It means they come to the Brahman platform. So Shonaka Rishi is an example of such a person, Jigyasu. He wanted to know. And the Artha, Arti. They want to enjoy land, money, sons, or a wife in this life or in the next, but they go to Krishna. They don't go somewhere else. They don't go to the demigods. And they, to get their needs. So Dhruva Maharaj is given as an example of an Artha. So all these three, the Artha, Artha Arti, and Jigyasu, these are all considered Sakam Bhaktas. So what they're doing is they're doing their activities, they're performing their duties, but it's with, they want the result to some, at least to, you know, some degree. They're interested in a specific result. So this is called Sakam. Well then Krishna just explains so this is all Karma Misra Bhakti. Right? It's we're talking about Karma Yoga, right? But as Sakam, the karma aspect is emphasized more. So this becomes Karma Misra Bhakti. Right? Devotional service mixed with karma or desire for some fruitive result. Like that. They want something. You know, some material thing, some relief from a situation, or some knowledge. Then you have the Jigyatana, the Where is the Gyani? The fourth category is the Gyani, technically referred to as a Gyanamistra Bhakta, or Yogamistra. He approaches Krishna not to have his material desires fulfilled, but to gain knowledge and thus approach liberation. Therefore, he is on the Nishkam platform. Both Sukadeva Goswami and the four Kumaras are examples of this kind of pious soul. Is that they want to go? They want to know Krishna. They want to actually go beyond. The Jigyasu is only interested basically maximum up to the platform of Brahman. But the others, they are beyond that. They want to know beyond. So that's the Jnani. So the Jigyasu is interested in knowledge, but still for his own means. Jnani is interested for going beyond. In other words, some actual proper platform. Like that. So this is Nishkam Karma. Or Gyan Mistra. That's why you'll see that so much, when it's describing Nishkam Karma, so much emphasis is given on the point of understanding who we are and that knowledge and the Gyan that's there. It's because it's considered Gyan Mistra. Right? One has to understand, one has to go for it. It's something one can relate with. We have the intelligence, we use it, we gain this knowledge. It's a platform we have to go through. And in this way, we can also see the difference between karma mistra, jnana mistra, and pure bhakti. So this is the different platform. So karma mistra is sakam, karma yoga. Then jnana mistra is nishkam karma yoga, which is what Krishna is recommending. Because he says you can, that person is very dear, as Krishna will point out now. Because there's a chance, Baladev Vidyabhushan comments on this, that a jigyasu is mentioned in the Sanskrit verse between an artha and an artharthi, because both will naturally progress to the jigyasu category as they advance in Krishna consciousness. It means you approach Krishna as with this material desire, to remove a situation or to get it, means remove an unfavorable situation, artha, or artharthi is to gain a favorable situation. But as they progress in their devotional practices, practicing the sakam karma yoga, they will start to come to the platform of knowledge. So they become jigyasu. It's the natural next stage. It's from the one, from either of those stages, gaining a good situation or losing an unfavorable. They'll both come to the platform of knowledge. Right? So he says, Baladev Vidyabhushan says, that's why Krishna puts it in that order. He puts them in between, because both of those will take that up. Like that. And it says, then he makes this point, if they are not curious about Krishna consciousness, they don't get into the philosophy and all that, then they are likely to later give up their interest in Krishna's service. Right? They may be just distracted. They haven't rejected it like the Mayaya Pratijnana. But they maybe get distracted and then, you know, then go to the heavenly planets or something else where they can fulfill these desires. Right? But if they do reject, then they can also then become Naradhama, where they've rejected the actual process because it didn't give what they wanted. They came for material purpose, right? They surrendered to the Lord. The Lord didn't give them what they wanted, and they're not interested in the philosophy to understand maybe there's something more behind it, right? Right? We look at, I surrender to the Lord, I go, Lord, please do this for me, you know? And it doesn't happen. Then we think, you know, what is this? I prayed to the Lord. You know, it didn't happen. So then one rejects the whole thing. You know, God doesn't exist, or this process is useless, or that. Then one becomes, even though one was in the beginning, an artha artharthi, but now he becomes a Naradhama. You see, he rejects it. So one has to be careful with that. So we see, we have to be careful with this. So the point is that if there's some problem, then there must be something beyond that. Because we've taken up devotional service surely Krishna's taking care. Krishna's made the point. Anyone who surrenders, he's taking care of them. He's made that point very clear. Right? But he takes care of them in a way different from what's going to come up after this. He's going to talk about the demigods after this. Because those who surrender to the demigods, they want fast results. Well, if you surrender to Krishna, Krishna will give you the material result you want, but he'll take a little time. He'll first purify you. Then when you're pure, he'll give you the result. Right? And then you don't want it. Right? But you have it. And Krishna expects you to use it. So that means you've approached him from Sakam, but he'll purify you and bring you to the platform of Nishkam. That's Krishna's trick. So those who want to avoid this cleverness of the Lord just go to the demigods. Right? They just go to the demigods. So now in this, there's a philosophy behind that. We're not the body, all these different things like that, how the material modes are working, our process of being purified. So much philosophy is there. So if one is interested, one has approached Krishna and then wonders why this is going on, and he actually wants to know, then by the association of the devotees, then we take up learning the philosophy. So then we progress. And with time, but the more we understand the philosophy, then we're able to give up the desire for the fruits, and then we can change from the Sakam Karma Yoga to Nishkam Karma Yoga. So it's a natural step, like that. Sakam wanting material desire, Sakam wanting just some knowledge, to coming to the platform of Nishkam. So this is a natural transformation. But if we don't do that, then we'll just think, hey, I approached God, he didn't give me what I wanted, then this process is useless, so I'll do some other process. So when we reject that, then that becomes very dangerous, because then we can fall into the category of not a dhamma. Because all the acharyas make it clear that that's what it is. Though Prabhupada says it very sweetly. You know? He says, sophisticated, cultured, civilized, but has lost the opportunity. He says, the civilized form of human life is meant for reviving the lost consciousness of his eternal relationship with the Supreme Truth. Right? That's what civilized life is for. That's why someone who has an interest is put into that family. Right? The opportunity has been given. Civilized human life is meant for that. Reviving lost consciousness of his eternal relation with the Supreme Truth, the Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, who is all-powerful. Whoever loses this chance is classified as a Naradhama. Loses the chance, and you gave it up. You didn't take it. He didn't say Naradhama is someone who will never take up, who is not interested. Right? That's more the Mayaya Pratijnanas, or the Asuras. Or the mudas. Mudas, just you tell them about spiritual, no interest. Couldn't care less. Right? But the Naradhama means they have the opportunity. They think about it, but they think, forget it. So they become the lowest because, you know, they all rejected the process. Like that. So one has to be very careful of this. Because every soul is a pure, eternal servant of Krishna. So everybody has the opportunity to go up, and everybody has the opportunity to go down. But generally, once you've taken up Krishna's service, he doesn't really let that happen to you. Right? So it won't be... Yeah. Generally, Krishna will try his best to keep one from that kind of mentality. Okay, now Krishna explains who he considers the best of these four. This is 17 and 18. Of these, the one who is in full knowledge and who is always engaged in pure devotional service is the best. For I am very dear to him and he is dear to me. All these devotees are undoubtedly magnanimous souls, but he who is situated in knowledge of me, I consider to be just like my own self. Being engaged in my transcendental service, he is sure to attain me, the highest and most perfect goal. So now he's mentioned that there's four kinds of persons surrender, but the jnani is the best. Because the jnani is free from material desires. He doesn't want material facility or knowledge. He just wants to know how to serve Krishna. That is his interest. He is not on the perfect platform, but that is his desire to perfectly please Krishna. So therefore, he becomes most dear. Right? They are dear to Krishna, and Krishna is dear to them. So both this is there. So he points this out. He takes that extra step. He says he's the best, and then he says, they are very dear to me, because I am dear to them. He brings this point out. Yeah. So here it's pointed out that the verse is called the Eka Bhakta. In other words, that one-pointed determination, Vyavasayatmika Bhuti, is fixed on pleasing the Lord, serving the Lord, somehow or another progressing to the Lord. That makes him very dear. Because he's not Vedavadarata. He's not bewildered by many desires. He wants this, he wants that, so many branches of knowledge, so much material facility, he wants some of that, all of that, like that. He's given all that up, he just wants Krishna. So that makes him very dear. Right there. So here, when it says jnani, then it's saying that it refers to one who has abandoned the pursuit of jnana. It means knowledge for knowledge's sake. He just wants to know. No, this is... He wants the knowledge so he can properly, more better understand his position, Krishna's position in the material world, and how he can best better detach himself from the material nature and attach himself to Krishna. So when it says jnani, it means real knowledge. Jigyasu, we're still talking about a good chance aparavidya. You know, or just the basics. Platform of the paravidya, the transcendental. Just I'm not the body, and it's interesting, nice to know, right? Like there was a fashion some years back that in a Bhagavatam class you had to say something that no one's heard about before. You had to throw in something new. You know, then everyone would say, "Wow, that's a nice class." But it's something you hadn't heard before, so it was, you know, great, some new piece of knowledge, like that. So that we're not talking about that kind of thing. We're talking about that understanding of Krishna. We're trying to get to that understanding, that realization. Jigyasu is not so much worried about realization as just get some knowledge, some understanding. But the jnani wants the realization. Therefore, he serves, he works, he's the nishkam karma, karma yogi. All right? Baladeva Vidyabhushan says that the jnani, the devotee in knowledge who desires only Krishna's service, is so dear to Krishna that the Lord is not satisfied to characterize him as the best. Thus he adds, he is dear to me. So he points out that Krishna could have just said he's the best, but because he's not satisfied with that, Krishna then goes on to say, he is dear to me. Then, after hearing this, then naturally you might think, well, the others aren't dear to Krishna. So in this point, then 18 makes this point clear, that all devotees are undoubtedly magnanimous souls. Right? Means they're special. Anyone who surrendered to Krishna is special. Like that. And Krishna considers that. But he considers that the one who has situated a knowledge of himself. Situated means... They understand it, they practice it. That's the jnani. Then they are just like his own self. Right? Being engaged in my transcendental service means nishkam karma, means it's transcendental. He is sure to attain me, the highest and most perfect soul. Then Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he explains about these three kinds of worshippers. He makes the point. Then, are the three kinds of worshippers beginning with the distressed, then not dear to you? Then Krishna says, that's not at all the case. Those who worship me, taking something they want from me, which I was prepared to give them anyway, are very dear to me. They are giving so much to satisfy me, and I am very affectionate to my devotees. The jnani, however, is like my own self. While worshipping me, he does not desire any benefit, neither attainment of heaven, nor liberation, nor anything else. Therefore, in my opinion, such a jnani is my very self, and I become subordinate to him. The implied idea is, I accept him as my very self, because he has concluded that I, in my form as Shyamasundara, am the supreme goal, not disillusion in the formless identity of Brahman. There's also there is a Nishkam Karmi who can come to that platform of giving up the material nature and renouncing from that, realize the super soul and then want to merge in the super soul. They come to the Brahman platform and then merge into the Brahman. So he's not talking that. The jnani is meaning one who has surrendered to Krishna, who is a devotee. Oh, here we are. In this way, the jnani, by possessing bhakti that predominates over other tendencies and is devoid of ulterior motives, becomes to be considered by the Bhaktivatsala Supreme Personality of Godhead as his own self. But the devotee whose devotion is completely pure, who has no other desires at all, the Lord considers even greater than his own self. Then this is quoted from Bhagavatam 11:14-15. My dear Uddhava, neither Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, Lord Shankarshan, the goddess of fortune, nor indeed my own self are as dear to me as you are. Lord Krishna is Atmarama, self-satisfied. Still, he is inclined to enjoy with the gopis. This indicates that he considers the gopis even more dear than his own self. Sukadev Goswami said, smiling upon hearing despondent words from the gopis, Lord Krishna, the supreme master of all masters of mystic yoga, mercifully enjoyed with them, although he is self-satisfied. That's Bhagavatam 10:29-42. So here we see that there's the devotees, the sakam. They are performing devotional service, but there's a predominant emphasis in their service on the karma and its results. Then the next stage is this jnani, who is performing nishkam. So the emphasis is more on the jnana than on the karma. He's performing the activities, but without any desire for results. And then as time goes, he starts to put more emphasis on the bhakti, though it's still not completely pure. So this person, Krishna considers as this good as himself. But for that devotee who has come to the platform where bhakti is the main thing, completely, the pure soul, then Krishna considers that person as more dear than even himself, greater than himself. Because Krishna then gives himself to that person. Right? The other is like they're... He considers them like him. And the other, he's very compassionate. We see those who have the desire, material desires, they approach it. Krishna says, I'm prepared to give it anyway. You know, because he has affection for his devotees. They want a material desire, they have it, they have some anxiety, some need. I give it. I want to give. You know, just like the parent. One could say, well, the kid's really materialistic, you know. I mean, all they do is take from the parents and... Parents are always giving, giving, giving. What do they give back? You know, who are these nonsense guys? You know, throw them out in the street or something like that. No, parents won't hear that. No, that's the rasa. Right? You go to God, give me all these things, and that's you've established a relationship. You know? So if there's a kid, you don't know them so well, they come to you and say, can you help me? Can you do this for me? This and that. You've established a relationship. And if they're nice, gentle, they're surrendered, properly behaved, you naturally help them. It's just part of the rasa. It's not a problem. So Krishna has no problem with the sakam bhaktas, that he considers them bad or useless at all. No, he's happy to give. He's going to give them anyway. But he's not happy to leave the relationship only on that platform. Because basically it means it's only one way. The child with the parent, it's basically one way. The parent just gives and the child just takes. And once they get what they want, you know, they run off and play. Right? They don't sit around the house all day. They run off. So it's not a constant relationship. So Krishna wants to bring it where that relationship is constant. So you can only do that when they detach themselves from the material nature. It means how much you're interested in the material nature, to that degree you can't be interested in Krishna. It's not that you can be fully interested in Krishna and fully interested in Maya. No, they don't have anything to do with each other. You can't be saying, yes, I'm facing the sun so there's no shadow. At the same time, I have my back to the sun, and so I'm enjoying the shadow. I'm enjoying both, the shadow and the sun. You can't, it doesn't work like that. You face the sun, there is no shadow. You face the shadow, there is no sun. So you can be turning and see both, but how much you've turned, it's just getting smaller. So to that degree, that the Sakam Karma Bhakta has that interest in material nature, to that degree he'll not be thinking of Krishna. So Krishna wants to increase that relationship, that exchange, because that's what makes them happy. Approaching the Lord, receiving from the Lord, that's the actual thing that made the devotee happy and the Lord happy. The devotee enjoying the facilities doesn't really give them the happiness, because that's just mental concoction, that this facility will give me happiness. Krishna already explained this in previous chapters. It's mental concoction. They think it's making them happy. It's not making them happy at all. Not possible. Right? Material nature cannot, which is material, cannot make the soul, which is superior spiritual nature, happy. It just doesn't work. You know, it can't, it doesn't work like that. Yeah. So they are also dear, but he turns them into, by fulfilling their desires, slowly, slowly, he brings them to the point where they lose interest in those desires and makes them into nishkam karma bhaktis, makes them into jnanis. Then he considers that person like himself, because they're always endeavoring, though it still hasn't come to the platform of pure unalloyed devotional service. But the devotional aspect is the prominent feature in their activity. Performance of their duties with the knowledge, but for the purpose of trying to understand Krishna, to please Krishna. So when it comes to the point where they're just doing to please Krishna, comes to the purity platform, then Krishna considers they are better than himself. Right? So this is devotees. They're all very, very dear to Krishna. Then in So now Krishna explains the rarity of devotional service. After many births and deaths, he who is actually in knowledge surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very rare. So actually in knowledge means we surrender. Right? So those who surrender are rare. Right? They're rare. And of those who have surrendered, those who have actual knowledge, where they fully surrender, those are even more rare. Yeah. Yes, so point is made here that the artha, jigyasu, and artha arti must come to the jnani's level before they can go back to Godhead. And going back to Godhead, you know, starts to get serious at nishkam karma bhakti. Otherwise, then, you know, it takes more time. One has to get to that point. Because as long as you want matter, you won't be satisfied going back to Godhead. Right? That's the point. If you want material facility, you won't be happy in the spiritual realm because there's no material facility there. Right? You want a big position or you want some wealth or fame or something. You won't be happy because you won't get that there. Right? Not material. And that's what the mind is attached to. So material, these things, it doesn't want. You know? You're not going to be satisfied, right? I mean, Chaitanya's pastimes, they're all just simple poor Brahmins who live in grass houses. Well, you're not going to be happy. Kolabetra Sridhar, right? He has a few banana trees. He gets a few banana flowers from them. You know, a little bit of this tor, this heart of the banana tree. He makes some cups out of the leaves and the bark. And he sells that. So you don't, it's not a thriving, you know, multinational business. This, it's a very simple thing that you just get a little bit of return from. In fact, Lord Chaitanya comes every day and steals one of his banana flowers and all that. So that definitely reduces the profits right there. So whatever he gets, he takes it back and dutifully, as a grihastha, spends 50% on worship of the Ganga. Right? And then with the other 50%, he adjusts his lifestyle and lives according to that. So now if you were, you know, into facility, definitely one would not be satisfied with this kind of service. So we don't hear of him, except for, what's his name? Rishabhanu Maharaj? Gadadhara's Pandit School? Pundarik Vidyanidhi. Okay, he's the only one, and Maharaj Pratapurugya, that you hear of with lots of money, you know, lots of facilities and position. So, but in the past times, these two spots are already taken. So that only leaves spots for more poor Brahmins living in grass houses. So he won't be satisfied. Therefore, one doesn't go back to Godhead. So when one comes to the platform Nishkam Karma, the Jnani, then one only wants Krishna. He has that Vyavasayatmika Bhuti. He's fixed on Krishna. Then one can be satisfied going back to Godhead. But before that, one won't be. So it's not a matter of, you know, Krishna doesn't take or it's not fair. It's you don't want. Right? We don't want if that is our desire. As soon as we give up that desire, then it becomes very possible. It becomes very possible. Yeah, so it says here, bhakti is even rare amongst these jnanis, means that they come to that full platform, because we come to the platform nishkam, and then we fully surrender. Right? There's still something we're keeping there. That's natural. We're in the process of being purified. So now it's just a matter of how you look at it. You know, this is the viewpoint. One can look at it, is the glass half full or half empty? Right? So basically, Krishna and the Acharyas look at it as half full, you know. But so we have to be very careful at ourselves. We don't look at it, well, it's half empty. No, because Krishna says that anyone who surrendered to him is very rare and very dear. Right? Now, maybe the cup is only quarter full. Right? But with time, it will become more. From Sakam we come to Nishkam. From Nishkam we come to Bhakti, full Bhakti, full surrender. So that is very rare. Samahatma Sadurlabhav. So we have to endeavor for that. We should make that the goal and endeavor. Then it becomes very nice. So now Krishna, now the point where it may come up, then it's pointing out, well, okay, now you've given those who have surrendered to Krishna, and the four pious souls who surrender, the four impious who will never surrender. But what about those who surrender to others, you know, demigods and the impersonal Brahman and that, you know, Krishna doesn't even count in the equation. So what about them? So then Krishna explains that here, in verses 20 to 22, about the demigod worship. Those whose intelligence has been stolen by material desires surrender unto demigods and follow the particular rules and regulations of worship according to their own natures. I am in everyone's heart as the Supersoul, and as soon as one desires to worship some demigod, I make his faith steady so that he can devote himself to that particular deity. Endowed with such a faith, he endeavors to worship a particular demigod and thus attains his desires. But in actuality, these benefits are bestowed by me alone. So Prabhupada points out that the less intelligent, they don't go to Krishna, they go to the demigods, because they're generally in the lower modes, passion, ignorance. So they're attracted by the facilities and the styles of worship of the demigods. So therefore they approach the demigods. Now, as we pointed out before, they think they're going to get the desires fulfilled quicker than going to Krishna. You know, everyone knows Krishna is very clever. The Vrajabasis, you cannot trust them. They say one thing, do another. So you approach Krishna, you may get, you may not get, you know. You get on his terms rather than on your own terms. So these demigod worshippers just approach Krishna. They're not interested in, I mean, just approach the demigods. They're not interested in approaching Krishna. Yeah. So another interesting point here is that this point of that when one wants to worship the demigod, then Krishna in the heart, Supersoul, makes the faith strong. Then only they can have that faith that this demigod is going to give. So one may inquire, why would Krishna do that? Because the purpose is that we have to surrender to, we have to know that things are coming from a higher platform. Right? So we're not getting it ourselves. The demoniac mentality is I'll get it myself. The pious mentality is I'll go to someone else, higher than me, in authority, someone more powerful. So that's that. If one has that mentality, then with time, if one comes in good association, one can accept the principles that I will surrender to the Supreme Lord, and He will fulfill everything. So you can start the Sakam Karma Yoga. Otherwise, you're just performing Karma Yoga. But you can switch. Right? Krishna's mentioning that before by association. So at least they're pious, and they're following the process of sacrifice. So it's better than someone who's uncivilized and doesn't, just thinks they'll make their own arrangements. Right? Because it's just, but it's still not so good. But the point here is that that faith can be made strong, so we should want to approach Krishna and desire that that faith be made strong by Krishna in Him, approaching Him. That we should try to do. Okay. Then, now Krishna explains here in 23, where does everybody go? He's explained the devotees and now the demigod worshippers. So he says, 23, men of small intelligence worship the demigods, and their fruits are limited and temporary. Those who worship the demigods go to the planets of the demigods, but my devotees ultimately reach my supreme planet. So the demigods, the worshippers of the demigods, they want some facilities. And the devotee wants to serve Krishna and go back to God, and please Krishna. So because the demigods are temporary, their fruits are temporary, then the worshipper of the demigod gets a temporary result. And the worshipper of Krishna, because he's worshipping on the transcendental platform, he gets a transcendental, eternal result. So it's just natural. Krishna says, as you approach. Right? So the Vedic literatures are also sacrificed. Krishna says it's all His path, but we've only surrendered to Him in this way. We've approached Him only through His limbs. And we just see those limbs as Him. I mean, as separate from Him. They're not worried about the Supreme Lord. They're worshipping the universal form, but they're not seeing that these are carrying potencies of the Lord. So they don't get this spiritual result. Well, we see that Prabhupada points out here. Yeah, Prabhupada points out here is that the point may be raised that the demigods are different parts of the body of the Supreme Lord. Then the same end should be achieved by worshipping them. Right? The universal form, the demigods are the different limbs of the Supreme of the universal form. So you could worship them, you should get the same result. Devotee approached the Lord, the demigod worshiper approached. But point is that you're approaching them separately than the Lord. So, and you're making the thing that through them I'm going to get everything done. No, but a certain place has a certain thing you can do. Like you feed the body, you can decide all you want. You're going to put the food in through your ears, but it's not going to nourish the body. You have to put it in the mouth. Right? So you have to surrender to Krishna. Yeah, so they think each is separate from the Lord. So this doesn't, it doesn't give the facility. They can't get. Now, he points out here that the demigods are worshipped with an understanding of their position as the Lord's expansions. Then the result of worshipping them is permanent. Bharat Maharaj is an example of one who worshipped the demigods as Lord Vishnu's agents, and not for material rewards. We see the also on the other persons on the Bhumandala. They worship the demigod as the embodiment of that particular potency of the Lord. So they worship the Lord. They're worshipping the Lord, but they're doing it through that demigod. So in this way, they're worshipping the Lord. But if you think that they're separate, you're worshipping just the arm, Indra, then, but you think he's his own, stands on his own and all that, then one will only get a temporary result. And then as Indra is temporary, the fruits Indra can give are temporary, and the destination that the demigod worshiper goes is also temporary. So like that. Then, Krishna mentions the impersonalists here. Unintelligent men who do not know me perfectly think that I, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, was impersonal before and have now assumed my personality, this personality. Due to their small knowledge, they do not know my higher nature, which is imperishable and supreme. So Krishna is saying a small intelligence. He calls the demigod worshippers men of small intelligence. But here he calls the impersonalists, you know, who think that Krishna's form is material, he calls them unintelligent. They get no credit. The demigod worshippers give some credit. They're just less intelligent. But here, these are unintelligent. So he's saying that they're worse. On the material world, you may think that they're higher because of the knowledge, but they're worse because they actually have no knowledge. So then the question may arise then, why these impersonalists, because they're engaged in the platform of jnana, they're transcendentalists, why they can't see Krishna. So Krishna mentions in this verse, I am never manifest to the foolish and unintelligent. For them I am covered by my internal potency, and therefore they do not know that I am unborn and infallible. Then in the next verses, then Krishna talks about bewilderment. O Arjuna, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I know everything that has happened in the past, that is happening in the present, and all things that are yet to come. I also know all living entities, but me, no one knows. O Skayana Bharata, O conqueror of the foe, all living entities are born into delusion, bewildered by dualities arising from desire and hate. So now Krishna is Sarvajna, so he knows everything. So Maya cannot cover him. Even his yoga Maya cannot cover him. He in his pastimes may agree as he wants. He's covered. He forgets he's the Supreme Lord. But he is not, yoga Maya cannot cover him unless he agrees. Like this. So Krishna is always omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient. He knows everything. There's no question of not. And he says, the living entities born into delusion, they have this dualities arising from desire and hate. There's always these two. Desire, one wants to enjoy, hate, then others who have something, who can influence you, have facility, have something you want. So such persons, they cannot know. Because ultimately, we maintain this hateful attitude. It goes back to that hatefulness of Krishna. He's the supreme authority. He's got everything. What do we hate? We hate people that have certain qualities, position, power, facilities. So Krishna is the ultimate. All facility, powers, and everything belong to him. So if you hate those things, then you ultimately hate Krishna. That's where it stems from. So we have to give up these dualities. When we give up this desire and hate, then also all these other dualities, heat, cold, and fame and infamy, all that disappears. So now, after hearing all this, now one may say, well, this sounds like a very tall order, that what we're supposed to go through and give up, and we've heard that only very few people come to this platform and everything. So then Krishna says, persons who have acted piously in previous lives and in this life, and whose sinful actions are completely eradicated, are freed from the dualities of delusion, and they engage themselves in my service with determination. So then Srila Prabhupada points out here, makes a very nice point here. The point is made is by the mercy of the devotees that others are get benefited. And that is the point being brought out here. The bhakta's business is to distribute Krishna consciousness to others. Srila Prabhupada writes, all the devotees of the Lord traverse this earth just to recover the conditioned souls from their delusion. So if it says here, pious persons are qualified to take the devotional service because they attract the attention of the devotees. Right? The advanced devotees, they get attracted by someone who's pious, properly behaved, inquisitive, interested. They turn to Krishna. So naturally, when you do that, you associate with the devotees. And then those devotees are kind upon them. They're merciful to them. And wherever the mercy of his preachers goes, that's where Krishna's mercy goes. So one advances because of this. So if someone's impious, improperly behaved, this, that, it's very difficult to attract the mercy of the advanced devotees. Therefore, Krishna says, the pious, persons who have acted piously in previous lives and in this life, whose sinful reactions are completely eradicated, are freed from the dualities of delusion. So because they're pious, then they easily come to Krishna. And then they get the association of the advanced devotees, and then they can go back to Godhead. So Baladeva Dibhushan, he makes a very nice point that Bhurijan Prabhu shows Prabhupada's unique magnanimous contribution in this way. So this is Baladeva. But do we ever find devotion for you in anyone? It seems that this would not be the case, judging by your statement that all beings in creation are born into delusion. As Krishna just stated that. This is answered. Those living beings who have received the merciful glance of the topmost pure souls will have all their sinful reactions destroyed. As stated in Shruti, the personal servants of Lord Vishnu wander this world to purify the conditioned souls. What characteristics are found in those who receive such mercy? This is answered by the phrase punya karmanam. Their activity of taking the darshan of great souls is punya, attractive or charming. Becoming firm in their vows and gaining determination by virtue of the association of great souls, they are freed from the delusion of duality. Coming to understand the truth about me, they engage in worshipping me. So, point being made here is how Prabhupada so widely just gave his mercy. So this is the point, is by associating with the pure devotees, the advanced devotees, then we also give up the material desires and come to this transcendental platform. We become attracted to Krishna, the sinful reactions go, these are anarthas go, then we become one-pointed, we become fixed, and with that determination, then we are able to attain Krishna. Then another kind of devotee here is mentioned. This is, we generally see in one chapter, a verse or two is given that is like a preview of what's coming up in the next chapter. So these are those verses. 29 and 30. Intelligent persons who are endeavoring for liberation from old age and death take refuge in me in devotional service. They are actually Brahman because they entirely know everything about transcendental activities. Those in full consciousness of me, who know me, the Supreme Lord, to be the governing principle of the material manifestation, of the demigods, and of the methods of sacrifice, can understand and know me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even at the time of death. So here Krishna's introduced a fourth kind of Sakam Bhakta. Like that, is one who is endeavoring for liberation from old age and death. So they take shelter of devotional service. Right? And he's introduced these concepts of Adi Bhuta, Adi Daivan, Adi Yajna, which will all be explained in the next chapter. So with this, basically, then Krishna ends this chapter. Adi Atma, the self, karma, doesn't give. Yeah, okay. Okay, so this fourth kind then means you have one who's interested in just some problem is happening now. I want it removed. I have a desire. I want it now. I want to gain that. Right? Or I have some interest in some knowledge. But now here the fourth one is someone who wants to be freed from the cycle of birth and death. He wants liberation. Like that. So basically it means, you know, more situated in goodness. Like that. So all these discussions will come up in the next chapter. So any questions or comments or... always the thinking, feeling, willing's going on. But point is like Krishna's example you gave, Krishna, I think this comes up in the later chapters, is that the senses are just, not especially the knowledge acquiring senses, are just, all they're doing is bringing in knowledge. I think the modern, I'm not sure what it is, some test, modern science, I think worked out that the knowledge acquiring senses, they pull in about 40,000 bits of information every minute, I think. Yeah, so that's all they're doing. But then the mind takes all that and reduces it down to what is kind of like, what is the main focus at present. And then from that, it then accesses the mind, the memory of the intelligence, and sees what were previous results from this. Was it good, bad, otherwise? And then it makes its decision. I want to continue like this. this is how the mind works. Just like we're having a conversation here, there's a kirtan going on that's practically as loud or louder than what we're doing. But if we focus on the conversation, we kind of cut that out. The mind leaves that. So the mind has all this going on, but it just kind of, according to the ego, according to the inclination, it chooses from out of all the stuff kind of what its interest. But then, you know, naturally something may make itself more prominent and then you change your attention and stuff like that. But the point, what I was making before was just that we should understand that we're not doing the things anyway. We're just making the choice and it's happening. So it's not that, you know, we're walking and we just think, well, you know, I'm going, do I go this, that? Only at points where there's need of a choice. Like I think, I'm going to the pujari room. So when I get up from here, I may not even think at all. I've just decided to go, and the modes of nature and everything to carry the body out the door. Then we have a choice. Do I want to turn right or left? And then once we do one of those two, we're not going to think again until we get down this way someplace. And depending upon our ego, if we're, you know, very practical and athletic and all that, we may decide to go up the roof without using the stairs. Or if we don't identify with that, then we won't think at all and just keep going till we get to the stairs and go up the stairs. Then we have a choice, then we get on the roof, then we, you know, there may be people up there, then we may decide, do we interface with them, or we see Tulsi, do we offer our obeisances, or this or that. And then we go in the door there, and then down into Pujari. So it's only at a few points then when there's a need for a choice. Otherwise, we've already made the choice, I'm going to the Pujari room, we'll just go by habit. It's just being carried out. But if there's need of a choice, you know, especially if there's no habit, then we will be making more choices more often. More desire will have to be entered into it. But once it's more habituated, then you have to think about it less. Yeah, because you don't have to do that. As I said, there's 40,000 bits of information coming in 1 minute. So that's a lot of opportunities. I mean, besides the kirtan here, there's also noise of water out there, there's the noise of the fan, you know. There's so many noises. But just which ones we pick are depending upon our desires, our ego, our purification. So which ones we pick, you know.
What about the case of a fucking animal?
That's basic. For the animals, that's called instinct. I think Prabhupada describes that, that's the super soul. So the super soul guides the animal because the living entity wanted to enjoy in a particular way or acted in such a way that they would get that particular situation. So then Krishna tells them what to do. So they just, according to their karma and according to that nature of that particular experience of living in that particular animal, then you'll do that. They'll always do the same thing. That's how you'll call them that particular animal. If you had a dog that was climbing trees and, you know, could fly, you wouldn't call it a dog, you know. But because they stay on the ground and they bark, and the cats climb up the tree, you call those cats, and the other one dogs. And that, and all over the planet you go, all the dogs do the same thing. You know, the basic fundamentals of dogdom, they all follow. And all cats follow the same basic principles. You know, all birds, whatever it is, they all follow the same traits. So when, that's just the super soul. The instinct is coming from the Lord, just directing. But for the human being, he lets you make the choice. His human life is for making the choice to go back to Godhead. And if you don't, then Krishna puts you in the species of life where you don't have to make choices. It's already worked out for you. Because there's no choice, there's no reaction. An animal gets no karma for what they do, because there's no choice. They're just living out the result. But for the human being, because he has choice, then there's responsibility. And then reaction is there. So either he'll get a good reaction or a bad reaction, depending upon his activity.
What is the meaning of that of the description in Bhagavad Gita when he's in the chariot of the, you know, chariot of the mind and the reins? Rain is the mind and the emotions and the senses. He's just
being carried away.
He's just being,
yeah. So they go from one goes into the next naturally, you know. They just follow each other. One activity. You're hungry, you find something, you look around for something. If you're hungry, the next thing that happens is you look around for things to eat. Then when you find something you want to eat, then you eat. And then after eating, generally you sleep. So I mean, they just follow. It's already been worked out. The different paths are, it's just like the train lines. The train line from Howrah to Delhi is already worked out. You know, the train line from Howrah to Bombay, Howrah to Madras. You get on, you go through the same villages, you can say exactly what's going to happen. Like that. So if you know the situation, you know what's dealing with it, you can even predict. You know? Like, you know, if you put a hungry man in a room with some nice food, there's every chance they're going to eat it. Like that. So you can predict what will happen. There's a natural course of the modes. Like that. So the living entity, because the mind is just doing its thing and accepting and rejecting based on our ego, it just goes, and the living entity has to sit there and go through it. But when you control the mind, then you start to make the decisions yourself rather than letting the mind do it. It means the ego will create the mind and the senses. From that, by your identification, then it mentions all the senses group around the mind. And then based on that, then certain things are nice to you, certain things not. Certain sounds are good, certain are not. Certain smells are good, certain are not. So you'll automatically, the mind will just go that way. Right? Two people are in the same place, experiencing the same situation. But one makes one choice, one makes another. It depends upon their ego. Because that has then created the basis on which the mind accepts and rejects. Therefore, they have a different set of senses. Right? They're tuned in a different way. Does that make any sense? All this kind of understanding is brought out much more in the last six chapters. You know, this kind of really nitty gritty of the jnana part. In other words, the first six chapters were on, basically on karma yoga, specifically nishkam karma yoga. Basically, sakam is not described that much because it's recommended as a starting point, but it's not dynamic. The nishkam is the dynamic aspect of it. So that's recommended. That would be also why it's mentioned here. Says those who are those who have acted piously in previous lives and in this life, and whose sinful reactions are completely eradicated, are freed from the dualities of delusion, and they engage themselves in my service with determination. So then we see in the purports they're talking about the combination of the preachers and those who are coming in contact with them. So the persons who are piously, they're coming in contact with those who engage themselves in my service with determination. So by that association, the one becomes the other. So this point of determination is very, you know, that comes. That's the, in other words, the madhyama, the preacher. That's that vyavasayatmika bhuti. You have that one point of determination to serve, to preach. So that is being emphasized in the first six chapters, with a little bit of extra emphasis on the jnana aspect, because nishkam karma yoga, there's more jnana than karma. And in sakam karma yoga, there's more karma than jnana. So the very So the understanding of the karma, the jnana, is very important for performing the activities. The nishkam karma yoga. So that will be further explained in the last six chapters. But now, for these next chapters, then the emphasis will be given on bhakti. Because without knowing your goal, how can you become vyavasayatmika buddhi? You have to actually know what the goal is and be completely convinced that that is the goal. Then one can step back and ask the questions, okay, now how do I act in this? What is the proper knowledge with which I'm going to perform the activities? So then the fine details, like you're bringing out, these must be known. If one wants to nicely perform Nishkam Karma Yoga, one has to know those. So those are given nicely in the last six chapters. After the goal is set so that one can be very fixed. Does that make some sense about why it goes in this order? If I'm going to have determination, I have to know the goal. Then once I've made that commitment, that sankalpa, then I can learn the technicalities. Okay, now you're real serious, now here's how you do it. But before that it becomes very, you know, in other words, in the first six we've gotten understanding this is what I should do and spiritual life and all that. But to make that commitment, I need to really know more about Krishna. I need to know more about Krishna, who's the goal. Then once that becomes very fixed, then what's in between where I am at present and Krishna, then that I can learn by this understanding more of the technicalities of jnana. Does that make some sense? Anything else?
Why was the
I'm not exactly sure. I think because that's what's going to come up in the next chapter. Because you always have. See, when you have black and white and you have gray. So you always have these main categories and you always have something a little this way, a little that way. That I'm not sure, I can't say. It may be more clear in the next chapter, because these are the opening basically for the next chapter, for the eighth chapter. Yeah, it says here, his position will be further discussed in chapter 8. Like that, so it will be discussed. Enthusiastic kirtan. What is
it? Always thinking of God, but anyways, not on what platform they are choosing.
Who? The asuras. As those who don't surrender to the Lord. That's a plan. Krishna just said, there are four kinds of persons who never surrender. So that's one of them. So, expecting something more esoteric than that? Just they never surrender because they don't like God. That's all.
The majority of the population of the four kinds don't surrender.
Generally, you find that the four kinds that don't surrender. In this age. Though you find, you know, in places where they follow the Vedic culture, then you'll also get a good, you know, good representation of those who go to the demigods or those who are into the impersonal understanding. But generally you'll find most of those in the impersonal understanding fit into the asuras. Because they're not actually Brahmavadis, they're Mayavadis. So Mayavadis fit into the category of asuras. But the Brahmavadis, then they're surrendering to the Lord, but it's not very deeply realized. But if they get the association of Nishkam karma or a pure devotee, then they advance. So we see that the four Kumaras, Sukadev, they were on this platform. But then they came in contact with the Lord and his devotees, and then they surrendered.
I look 10 years more, because Krishna says surrender unto me. But most of us, most of the population tell you that they can't surrender. So kinds of can't surrender. It gives them anyway. It makes them qualified.
Yeah, that's would be one of the main. I mean, there's so many, but I'm saying that's one of the main. That's described, I think, in the. I think it's in the songbook, in the purport to Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu. One of the songs to Lord Chaitanya Prabhu describes is that Advaitacharya, he's Mahavishnu, so he can easily save the whole world. But because here in Gita, Krishna said that as you surrender, he'll reciprocate. Then in the Kali Yuga, no one surrenders, so he can't reciprocate. So nothing happens. So then he calls Lord Chaitanya, because here the point's being made is that the devotees, the Lord's mercy follows the devotees, the preachers. The preachers go out and give their mercy to people. Krishna's mercy follows that. They are the carriers of the Kripa Shakti. And when they wish to give it to somebody, Krishna gives it to them. Like that. So gaining their favor is how one advances. So then, Lord Chaitanya is taking the mood of a devotee. So preaching is the thing. And therefore we see his movement is that of preachers. It's a preaching mission. Because then you're doing this, what is Krishna said here. Right? Pious persons who have acted piously in previous lives and in this life, and whose sinful actions are completely eradicated, are freed from the dualities of delusion, and they engage themselves in my service with determination. Right? So that is the mission, is doing that. Bringing in pious souls who can surrender by giving them an association of the advanced souls. And by such preaching, the advanced souls advance, and by such association, then the pious advance. So we'll only find that in the devotees. The Lord goes to do, but he says his main thing is he coming to associate with the devotees. Right? Where's that one? To destroy the miscreants, to establish religious principles, and to save the devotees. So he's basically coming for the devotees. While he's coming to see the devotees, he'll also remove the demons and establish religious principles. He'll do both those. Those come as, you know, side. But his main thing is to associate with the devotees. Because the devotees are so dear, because they preach. They give their association. Therefore, Krishna says you approach the devotee, the servant of the servant. Then it becomes perfect. Prahlad Maharaj was preaching. Nisringadev came, but he approached Nisringadev as the servant of a spiritual master. It's the servant of the servant. So in this way then, because the servant is pleased, the Lord is pleased, and we advance very nicely. Does that make any sense?
It seems that Lord Chaitanya was considering some of the pious or impious that could be included.
That is there. Just saying they Prabhupada said, I have made your fortune.
Huh?
He has created the piety. Like that. So that's the devotee's mercy. Now that was where was Baladev was pointing out here. I'm always amazed how something that's like two pages before where you were and then you can't find it. Oh, because I thought it was power game. It says here, Baladev is speaking. Now on this point, O Skaina Bharata, O conqueror of the foe, all living entities are born into delusion, bewildered by dualities arisen from desire and hate. Prabhupada says, such a deluded person symptomatically dwell in dualities of dishonor and honor, misery and happiness, woman and man, good, bad, pleasure, pain, etc., thinking, this is my wife, this is my house, I am the master of this house, I am the husband of this wife. These are the dualities of delusion. Those who are so deluded by dualities are completely foolish and therefore cannot understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Right? So Baladev points out here. But do we ever find devotion for you in anyone? It seems that this would not be the case. Judging by your statement, means Krishna's statement, that all beings in creation are born into delusion. And then Krishna answers. Those living beings who have received the merciful glance of the topmost pure devotees will have their sinful reactions destroyed. As stated in Shruti, the personal servants of Lord Vishnu wander this world to purify the conditioned souls. It says, what characteristics are found in those who receive such mercy? This is answered by the phrase punya karmanam. So they've received the mercy, so they've gotten punya karma. Right? They've taken darshan of these souls. By seeing them, by hearing from them, by serving them, that is their punya. But, then comes the other side. Then, becoming firm in their vows and gaining determination by virtue of the association of great souls, they are freed from the delusion of duality. Coming to understand the truth about me, they engage in worshipping me. And that's this verse here. So then they come to that platform. And then they carry on the... Yeah, it says, Purijan says here, how munificent then was Srila Prabhupada. He so widely cast his purifying glance that it fell upon even the impious and those engaged in most unfortunate works, and thus he created their punya karmanam.
Living proof.
Yes. At least I can say for myself. You know what it says? Impious and those engaged in most unfortunate works. Of course, I can't claim most unfortunate. I can claim unfortunate. As Prabhupada said, we're not the most anything. Yeah. Yeah. So those who... That Madhyama sees the Lord, the devotees, the innocent, and the, what do you call it? Those who are uninterested. What's the term that Jalan used? Huh? Demons. So, yeah, Mayavadis fit in that category, so the devotees just stay away from them. So only the innocent, that's why it says the pious here. Persons who have acted piously in previous lives. So the innocent, these are pious to some degree. In some aspect. No one's in this age, of course, you find very hard to find completely pious. But you may find those who act pious, but material desire is there. You know? Or you have those who are very impious in their behaviors, but then they have some pious side. Like it's not uncommon that those who are like how you say, in Vraja, then the dacoit villages, if a sadhu goes there, they take care of him better than, you know, others who would be considered pious. Because they know I'm doing so much nonsense and I gotta, you know, do something right sometimes. So you see, sometimes people who their work, their occupational duty is not very pious, many times they're very religious. Because they're trying to make up for, you know, like that. So you get that, they're very religious that way. So if they come in contact, then they may change their ways. Dasaratnakara was like that. Dasaratnakara was not at all. He was bad news. You know, he didn't blink an eye to kill somebody, to steal from them. So he sees the sage coming, and he jumps out on the path and says, "All right, give me whatever you have, or I kill you." You know. So the sage happened to be Narad Muni and says, "All right, that's no problem. I can give you everything, but." Why you're doing this? You know, why can't you do something else? You know, says, "Well, I got to maintain my family. You know, you got to eat, got to be practical." He says, "But you're doing this stealing and killing people and all, and it's, don't you know that that's sinful and all?" He says, "Yes, I know, but what to do?" He says, "But so you're doing this all for your family, right?" He says, "Yes." He says, "So because you're doing all these sinful activities, you must be getting reaction, but you're doing it for the family. So naturally, because of your affection for them, they must have affection for you. They will also be happy. They must be also taking some of the reactions." So then, and Dasaratnakara, "Yes, of course." And he says, "Do one thing, go back and just check that that's what's going on. Otherwise, you're working so much and doing all these bad things for them, you should see that they're willing to take." You know? And Dasaratnakara is thinking, "What's going on here?" He says, "But if I go back, then you'll run away." He says, "No, I'm a sage. You know, he says, I give my word. If I say I'm going to be here, I'm going to be here." So he said, "Okay." So he went back to the house and he, you know, got his wife and children together. And he asked them, "You know, I'm doing all these sinful activities, killing people, stealing, all these kind of things. So this gives reaction. So now you're sharing with me the fruits of this. Then surely, you know, out of your affection for me, you must also be sharing the sinful reactions that come with it." And the wife and kids said, "You know, forget it. No, that's what you're doing. I mean, you know, you've chosen this occupation like that. You're just supposed to take care of us. So that's your problem, not ours." So he's very bewildered, you know, because he somehow or another thought the relationship was a little deeper than that. He didn't think it was so shallow. You know, this is the illusion of most men, is they think the relationship with the wife is quite deep. So then he found out it wasn't. So he was very bewildered. So he went back to the sage. And he told, and Narad Muni is there smiling, and he sees him coming, so he can understand what the answer was. Then he came back and he said, no. So he was very disappointed. So then Narad Muni preached to him, you know, then why do all these things? I mean, if you're doing this to support the family and please them, and, you know, you're being pleased and a nice exchange and all the rasa that's going on, but there is no real rasa, it's very shallow, like that. And he was very disappointed. So then he asked what to do. So then Narad Muni says, "So now you should chant the Lord's name. You're so sinful, you should surrender to the Lord, to chant the Lord's name." So he says, "Okay, what should I do? What should I chant?" He says, "Chant Ram." He couldn't chant it. He was so sinful, he could not utter Ram. So then Narad Muni thought, and he says, "Can you say kill?" "Kill, yes, no problem, I can say that. I do that all the time." So that in Sanskrit is Mara. Right? So then he says, "Well, can you chant Mara?" Right? It means kill, 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 kill. No problem, I can chant that. So he sits down and just starts chanting Mada, 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 Ram, Ram. And then with time, he gets purified, he's chanting Ram. Right? Then after this, then he, now by the grace of the spiritual master, he became a sage and he lived in the forest and all this. And because of his devotion to Ram, then all the pastimes of Ram were revealed within his heart, and he wrote those all down into the Ramayana. So this Dasaratnakar was Valmiki, became the sage Valmiki. So this is the potency of the pure devotees, teachers. So you get that, even though they're sinful, they have a religious side. So the lowest are those who are sinful, get the opportunity for devotional service and reject it. They're the worst. They're the lowest of men.
There's also in the Bhagavatam we're reading now, next chapter, there's a hell where those people who are born in aristocratic families go, but don't practice what they're supposed to do, and simply they don't practice what they're supposed to do in aristocratic families. There's a hell, especially for them. And they're not maintaining that.
That's an interesting point. So it really brings out the position, those born in aristocratic families, very much that's for a particular purpose. Those born in devotee families and aristocracy or in Brahmin families, religious families, that's for that purpose of advancing in, you know, human life. As you see, especially in India, aristocratic families are so cultured, gentle, clean. These all good qualities are there, just naturally, automatically. You see. But because they have wealth, then they can become degraded. So we see in India, because they have wealth, these rich families, and they get into Western lifestyles, which more, less opulent people can't afford. That. So then they can degrade themselves very quickly. So it's interesting that there's a hell just specifically for them. Otherwise, why be born in such a family? I was hearing once, last year, there was some lady was here, and she was describing about her mother. So they were from royalty, from, I'm not sure which state. Maybe it's Himachal Pradesh. I think they're originally Rajputs, but it's just somehow or another their original kingdom was over that side in Himachal Pradesh. And they live in Calcutta. So they're in the royal blood. But, you know, now they have no facility for it. And the mother used to keep, I think, the father's or grandfather's sword. Nice sword, the fighting sword. A nice case and everything, and they always have a nice stand for it. It doesn't sit in the corner, but it's on display. And it was on a very prominent table in the house, in the living area or something like that. And her mother used to tell her, says, "You don't act properly." And sometimes the daughter would ask, "What's this sword? And what's the significance of this sword?" The mother would explain, "If you don't act properly, I pull the sword out and kill you." "You're born in this family, and we have standard of culture and behavior to maintain. So if you don't learn it and follow it, you don't deserve to be in this family." Like that. She was saying she was so afraid of her mother, like that. And then her mother's sense now, father died and she's grown up, so the mother is now retired to Vrindavan. She's one of those widows that lives in Vrindavan. And she said that she went to visit her. The daughter went to visit the mother. And she goes and visits her, and ask how she is and her health and this and that. And mother asks, you know, one or two questions, how everybody is, and that's it. And after 5 minutes, then, you know, conversation kind of stops. And mother asks, so, anything else? You know, why are you still sitting here? And daughter, well, I just came to, you know, be with you, this and that. Says, for what? And it's like, well, you know, just to be around. And that's just, you know, it's no service. You know, there's nothing, you're not thinking of the Lord, doing any service for the Lord, so what's the use? That cultures. Even you go back in, even in the European culture, I don't know how far you have to go back, but definitely back some years, is that when it was dinner time, the family would eat. They all had to eat together. No question of this one eating here, that one there. They all had to sit at the table. And, you know, they had to be proper conversation and proper behavior and saying of prayers and this and that. And if someone didn't want to follow that, they had to leave. Right? There'd always be the comment, you know, somebody gets all upset about something. The father would just say, in this house, these are the rules. You follow them, fine, you're here. We're here to take care of everything. You don't want to follow, you're free to leave. You know, this house has a standard. You want to be here, you follow it. And I'm sure you go back some years in Europe, you know, the European culture, even there it's. So it's still to some degrees going on. Families that have a tradition and have some, you know, to some degree some culture, then they expect it to be maintained. And if it's not maintained, then you shouldn't stick around. It's natural. Question is on the point about someone who approaches Krishna with material desire. When that desire is fulfilled, then they may be enthusiastic to continue. If it's not fulfilled, they may give up devotional service. So then she had heard that in some lecture that someone has said that unless one has done to become fixed in one lifetime, in this lifetime, means in last lifetime, one would have, should have done some bhakti sukriti. So in this point of those who approach Krishna also for material desire, there's those who get the desire fulfilled and after fulfilling it go away also. It's not necessarily only if they don't get it fulfilled they go away. And then in going away, then there's two categories. Those that reject the process and those that just become bewildered by material energy. So those who become bewildered by the material energy, they're not Naradhamas. They, having done some devotional service, then they go to the heavenly planets and then take birth in the aristocratic families or in Brahmin families in the next human form. And those that reject the process, thinking it's useless, they become Narottamas. Like that. But there's also those who get their desires fulfilled and may just, I just explained that. So now, those who get their desires fulfilled, they may also progress, because when Krishna fulfills the desires, he does so in such a way he purifies. So the idea is he's trying to bring one to the platform of Nishkam Karma Yoga. Trying to, in service without it, material desire. Right? So he'll try to bring you to that platform. So it's very natural someone's desires are fulfilled, but Krishna does it in such a way that you lose interest in that desire and you make advancement. But that's by the association of devotees. Then Krishna says here is then, naturally then that person who had done a small amount, then they come and they're born in an aristocratic family. Then they get the opportunity to take up devotional activities again. So then in that way you could say that person, because he's done it before, he's naturally attracted. And then, in this life, he may become more determined. Right? And go back to Godhead. So then one could look at it from that way, is that unless they've done before, they don't become determined. But then the point is also made here is by association, proper association with advanced devotees, one can go through all that in this lifetime. So both aspects are there. It's understood that one who is, that's the end of the eighth, isn't it? Oh no, that's the next. Yeah. The next chapter. Is that a person who accepts, this is the last verse, the person who accepts the path of devotional service is not bereft of the results derived from studying the Vedas, performing austere sacrifices, giving charity, or pursuing philosophical and fruitive activities. Simply by performing devotional service, he attains all these, and at the end, he reaches the supreme eternal abode. So basically, it's understood that devotees done all those things in the past. That. But at some point, we can say that in the last life you had to have done devotional service, but then in the last life, how did you get the opportunity to do that devotional service? Because karma and jnana and yoga for mystic perfection, I mean yoga, practice, unless it's devotional, cannot create bhakti. Bhakti is something else, it's independent. So at some point, you had to get the mercy of the devotee. That's all. So it's just a matter of how seriously we take it. If we take it very seriously, Prabhupada makes a point. In this lifetime, not only can you go back to God, qualify yourself to go back to Godhead, but even in this lifetime, you come to the point where you've entered into the transcendental pastimes while you're still in this body. You've received your spiritual body, and you're performing service by meditation in the spiritual world with that spiritual form while you're in this body. That is also possible. Right? So that's possible, but we have to be determined. Otherwise, then Krishna says here, after many births. Right? Not in this chapter. And in the last chapter. Mentions many times, so many verses and all that. So that's the normal way it would go. But if one is very serious in associating with devotees, that's why Rupa Goswami always recommends and associate with those more advanced than yourself. Find like-minded devotees that are more advanced, so that one can relate to them and have exchange. They can relate to you, because if they relate to you, then actually they're your well-wisher. and then that helps us advance. So that is, you know, what is it? Sadhu Sangha, Sarva Sadhu, Sarva Sadhu Sangha, Sadhu Sangha, Sarva Shastra Hoy, Lova Matra Sadhu Sangha, Sarva Siddhi Hoy. So just even a moment's association, Sarva Siddhi Hoy, means all siddhis, all perfections are available. So that's there. That's the element. That's like the wild card, right? Anything can get done with it. So if one is not taking so much association, one's just going through the process, then it may take many births. But if one is taking advantage of association, not offending devotees, especially the preachers, then it goes very quickly. You know, and Prabhupada's recommendation is finish up in this life. So, because he wanted it to happen, it's possible. You know, so with his blessings and desire, it is possible. Because Krishna is going to accept that. He's going to give that mercy according to the mercy of the pure devotee. Yes.
Prabhupada brings this point out in the 18th chapter, Sarvadharam Paritaja verse, in the purport. And he said, Krishna's already mentioned in the 7th chapter how, after many, many births of being pious, when one's sinful activity is eradicated, he can surrender and he can sit, but now, he says, in the 18th chapter, by that process alone of simple surrender, which means, you know, surrender, associated with devotion. By that process alone, simply surrender, then one actually bypasses all those other many, many births.
That's your answer. But isn't it interesting? Mam ekam sharanam raja. Mam ekam. It still is that vyavasayatmika bhuti. Basically it seems that one can get oneself to the platform of that vyavasayatmika bhuti. Basically from there, things go very, very quickly. Because already then Krishna considers that you are equal, of the same nature as him. He sees one as transcendental in that same situation. You know? But one is not, how do you say, he doesn't see that platform as greater than him. That's the, you know, pure unalloyed devotee. But if one can get oneself from Sakam to Nishkam Karma Yoga, right there, that seems to be the focus. Because if it was already on bhakti, pure unalloyed devotional service, then he could just say it in a shloka or two. But the point is he's giving process. So process means we have to go from a point stage lower than that to that. And if he was just speaking to people who are Brahman realized, then it wouldn't take much. We saw it didn't take long for the four Kumaras to turn from Brahmavadis into pure Vaishnavas. It took them to smell the Tulsi leaves while they were offering obeisances, and then to consider that I'm not materially contaminated, so I have no attractions and desires, so I'm attracted to this, therefore this must be spiritual. So what was that? Maybe 10 seconds? 15 seconds maximum? They went from the Brahman platform to pure devotional service. So it wouldn't take probably many shlokas, you know, if this treatise was meant for those on that platform. Because we're talking about someone lower than that platform, therefore so much explanation must be there. How to get to there, how to operate. Krishna's recommending Nishkam Karma Yoga. How to operate that. How to make it function. That's Abhideya. Abhideya is how to actually operate the system of devotional service. How to advance, how to progress myself to the platform of perfection. Sambandha means this understanding who God is, who I am, what is the material nature, what's the relationship. That's Sambandha. I am servant of God. My business is to engage the material nature in Krishna's service. That's Sambandha. And Prayojana is that love for Krishna is the ultimate goal. Right? So now Abhideya is that process. So that's what needs so much explanation. It means Sambandha explanation is there to convince us that we are soul, we're not the body, the material world is separate from us, and God is there and we are His servant. So as long as we're not convinced, then the aspects of Sambandha must be drilled. Right? At least on this platform is Sambandha. Then there's, of course, the spiritual body Sambandha. That's another thing. And then we give the goal. The goal must be given. Then once we've accepted the goal, we've accepted who we are, we accept the goal, then it's okay, how do I get there? That's the next natural. Then Abhideya. Right? So that's what he's saying, is that he's separating, Arjuna Krishna is separating between the difference between matter and spirit. And before doing one's activities for yourself and for doing it for God. And why? Because of God is the goal of life. And bhakti yoga, and then what it means. Then once you've established the sambandha and the abhideya, then you can come back with the working principles, the nitty-gritty that you're going to get the nishkam karma to work for you. And that's to really to be able to understand the difference between the body and the soul and all these different things. So it's natural that you go like that. Determines why someone could get a taste in devotional service and why someone wouldn't. Generally, it's due to how seriously one takes the process, how much one avoids offenses, how much you associate and follow the processes that are there for purification, that give taste. Right? The main elements that purify us. Most powerful are chanting Hare Krishna, associating with devotees, hearing Bhagavatam, worshipping the deity, and living in the holy Tham. So how seriously we take those up, and then how seriously we avoid offenses that are going to get in the way of that. And then that's all supported by our other aspects of our sadhana, you know, cleanliness and proper behavior and how we dress and act and all these things, you know. So if we do it seriously, then we get result. We don't, then we don't so much. Categories of? Motivation? What's the question? Does motivation and sincerity go together? See, it's what you are motivated for. Like the bhakta is motivated, he wants to please Krishna, he wants to see Krishna happy, therefore he works. You know, the jnani wants to advance in devotional service very nicely, you know, because that's the purpose of his life. You know, the sakam bhakta then, they have something to do, and they want to do devotional service. They know it's proper. But there's also very much material desires are there. So it's... As one associates with devotees, then one can understand these higher principles of motivation. That one is attracted to to, you know, proper behavior, proper application, and with the desire to please Guru Krishna and the devotees. Then it comes. And that sincerity must be there, and that sincerity is gained by proper association. So it basically always goes back to the devotees, proper association, following the instructions. As we get a taste for what we're supposed to do, then go away.
You're still attached to those tastes, and it's very difficult.
Yeah, that's there. I mean, if it's habit, that's one thing, but if it's like a determined attachment, that makes it very difficult. But habits just start to fade with time. Make practice, but if we determinedly hang on to something, that makes it very difficult. That becomes serious. But if it's not, it's just there, then by association, by proper practice, those things start to go away. It's like the inchworm. It puts its foot somewhere else first, and when it's firmly there, then it can lift up the other one. That's where Krishna, he opens the seventh chapter with that. No? The sixth is seven. What is called renunciation, you should know to be the same as yoga, or linking oneself to the Supreme, or son of Pandit. For one can never become a yogi unless he renounces the desire for sense gratification. What it comes, we see, is that in the process of linking, then naturally one gives up. So that's why he's recommending this nishkam karma. Because if we're conditioned, we have material desire. It's just the way it is, that we have to accept. And if we accept that, then we know the desire is there, but now let's engage in Krishna's service and engage in the positive aspects of devotional activities and avoid the very outstanding, gross aspects. Then naturally with time, one gets a taste for that and one becomes purified by that work, by doing the work for Krishna. We become purified. Then naturally we start to give up those tastes. They just fall away. So if we endeavor on cultivating the positive, then with time the negative will be able to be given up. But we still have to keep our eye on those negatives. That's the thing, is the weeds. We have to watch them. And we have to be endeavoring to pull them out. We can't just go ahead with one and avoid the other. Otherwise, then we'll fail as gardeners. But we have to. The whole idea is that you can put the emphasis on the positive aspects of performing prescribed duties for Krishna's satisfaction. Maybe we should. Śrīla Prabhupāda ki, samaveta bhakta brinda ki, jāyana sa gaura prema.